Okay, qualify briefly. At this time, the chairperson should briefly qualify. Requirements for chairing a meeting at the Central Orlando Group Saturday night speaker meeting or 1 year of continuous sobriety, have Central as your home group, and attend a group conscious meeting, which I've been to lots of those. And again, my name is Marissa. I'm an alcoholic. I won't spend too much time qualifying tonight because I want to give adequate time for our speaker. But I know when I came in here, I had a lot of problems. I had a lot of serious problems. And I thought when I came in here, drinking was my only problem. And what I found when I came in here was that drinking was actually the solution. And I really liked the way that it made me feel for a really long time. And then slowly over a period of years, it stopped working. I'm really grateful to be here tonight because what I continue to find as I stay sober and as I work with others, that I am reminded that, once we work the steps, and one of the reasons why I asked Kathy to read the promises tonight, that, we talk about all the good things that we experience coming into the rooms, but sometimes it's about the other stuff too, like the normal part of life that's not good, so good stuff, like death and sickness in the families and all that hard stuff. And regardless of whether something good's going on or something not so good's coming on, I'm still in here, and this is where I feel safe. So thank you for letting me chair tonight. And now I'm going to introduce the speaker. The last three speakers that I asked to speak this month, one of the reasons why I picked them was because they all found spirituality in these rooms, and I could identify with all of them a lot because that's really where I found spirituality too. And this next speaker I've known for 7 years, or almost 7 years. I've been sober for those years, and he just celebrated his 5th birthday recently. And I regard this person as a really good friend of mine, and he got here first. And it was a living testament to me, and I think other people as well, without even telling me really about what he was doing. It was the actions that he was taking, that his life was getting better. I've got to really see him grow up here, and I really respect the man that he's become. He always reaches out to newcomers, and I'm going to let you hear his story tonight. Welcome, Josh.
Hi, my name is Josh. I'm an alcoholic.
Hey, Josh.
And very grateful to be here tonight. Thank you to Marissa. When I was thinking about, what I was going to say or how to focus this, because, I've been fortunate enough to speak a number of times. I spent a couple of years my sobriety in New York, and all the meetings in the area I lived in up there start, every meeting starts with a speaker, so everyone gets drafted on a fairly regular basis, and gotten to share my story a couple of times. Just as I was thinking about it, the answer that came to me was that it's in the big book. As I find, all the answers today tend to be in that book, and I carry mine with me at every meeting. And I really like mine. I have a friend who thinks that it's a dead book and that I need to replace it with a new live one. Because the pages, mainly just the first 164, the back half is all in pristine condition, but the first 164 are just falling out. They tend to do this. I like it, though, because I can mark pages just by sliding them up now, as opposed to mark. So it actually comes in handy. And, what I thought of when I went into the big book is at the end of first chapter of the basic text, and there is a solution. It's on page 29, and it's when it's talking about the layout of the book, and it says, each individual in the personal stories describes in his own language and from his own point of view the way he established his relationship with God. And, when I share my story, when I carry the message, that's my responsibility today, and so I'm going to be telling you about how I found God. And finding him was just the beginning. I was sitting there thinking about it today, and I remember being 8-9 months sober and, having a very deep spiritual moment, a deep working my 11th step and having a meditation. And as I look back at myself and think about it today, at 9 months sober, 9 months away from the drinking, away from the craziness, how much better my life had become, having worked through the steps with a sponsor, helping work with other young people, getting involved in networks and activities, taking positions in my home group, how much things had changed in 9 months. And when I looked back and I saw myself at that point today, just the only thing I could think of was how much healing still needed to be done. You know, how wounded I still was, how raw in that moment of meditation, how much I really needed God to heal me. And blessed that I don't have those feelings today. Now, I tell people fairly often that, you know, somewhere around the 4 or 5 month mark after I did my fifth step, when I started doing some amends and, you know, the weight and the burdens and the guilt and the shame were all being lifted away. I could look people in the eyes. I was fixing relationships. You know, my life had never been better. And I was the happiest that I had ever been in my entire life. And if you let me trade and have that exact same amount of happiness, that amount of peace today that I had then, I would be completely miserable today. You know, and it's not that that wasn't real. That was just the most I had discovered. That was the best it had ever been. You know, but I've been blessed and fortunate enough to, as I continue to work this program, it keeps getting better. You know, and the level of peace that I've found, the understanding, the relationship I've developed with my higher power, with people around me, my fellows, is something that I didn't even know was possible then. And things were good then. Now, I'm very fortunate to have received the gifts and the blessings in this program. And, you know, I can't talk about it. I can't talk about it without talking about God. And the two things that I've found most when I think of God today is that God is truth and God is love. And it's very, very simple. Mainly God is love. I mean, I learned early on, I was taught about my motivations, you know, and they read for me in the big book how I can go anywhere as long as I check my motivations and know that they're right. And I was told that if I'm feeling anything other than love, that's me. That's the selfishness, that's the ego. That's the things that it says we must get rid of or else. And I needed to strip it away to love. And throughout this program, you know, throughout my time in sobriety, I've come to find a deeper understanding of love. And it comes as I find a deeper understanding of God. They tend to come together. Now, as I learn how to be a better person to the people around me, as I develop stronger relationships with friends, with family, with loved ones, I learn a little bit more about my relationship with God and what it's supposed to feel like and what it's supposed to be like. You know, and it works both ways. You know, the deeper I get in my meditations and my working the program, the closer I get to God, the more there is for me to share with those people around me. And it's something where I can just kind of keep going back and forth as long as I keep working it in both places, in my relationship with Him and my relationships with others. And it just continues to grow and deepen. So, you know, as I share my story, you know, and I talk about my past and when I was drinking and my time in recovery, you know, I might get a little excited at some points. I might, you know, you might discover that I'm still resentful about something that I didn't know I was resentful about. It happens sometimes. You know, but I can tell you, if I don't sound at peace, if it doesn't sound like love, then it's me, and you can just forget about it. Because the stuff that sounds like love, the stuff that sounds like I'm at peace, that's God. And, you know, that's the only thing. That's what I try to listen for when I hear people today. And I'm amazed at how often I can find it when I'm looking for it, now that I know what it sounds like. So, you know, to talk about my recovery, my sponsor talks about recovery, you know, and when I first started working with him, he asked me, he said, "What are you trying to recover?" And I didn't really have a good answer for him. And he asked, you know, it's called recovery. You know, what is it that you're trying to get back to? And I couldn't really think of what I was trying to get back to. And as I thought about it, I thought about my, you know, I was thinking, you know, the place before I started drinking. You know, I wanted to get back to before what the alcohol did to me, because the alcohol had done something to me. I thought it had changed me because I used to be good. And as I thought about my first drink, I remembered, you know, being 13 and how good it felt, you know, and how much I wanted more, and, you know, going through 3 whole bottles or something. And I remember going out and talking to girls and, you know, getting into a fight with some kid, and, you know, and then how tough I felt and how confident, and, you know, and I thought it was amazing. And I remember feeling like it solved my problems. It made me like the cool person it made me feel like the cool person I'd always wanted to be. It solved my problems. And the first time like I heard myself say that, when I told my sponsor that alcohol solved my problems, he goes, "Well, I guess you must have had problems before you started drinking." That meant that there was more things I needed to do work on. And you know, when we did the 4-step, he told me to go back and find my earliest memory, and I tried, and I thought I had, and as I continued to do work and continued to do inventory, as I continued to have to work on relationships with people, family members, namely my parents, you know, the very fractured, damaged relationships I had with my mother and father, I continued to find further things further back that, not that I had ever forgotten, but I hadn't really thought about lately. And it only took me about 3.5 years to find what I'm pretty confident today is my earliest memory. And I think I was about, I couldn't have been more than 3 years old. And now I remember being in a supermarket with my father, and he was getting a can of soda from a vending machine. And I asked if I could hit the button, and he told me he wanted Coke. And I hit the button, and it came out, and he started screaming and yelling at me. And he picked up the can and he threw it away and told me that now he couldn't have anything because I fucked it up. And he was so angry. And I didn't know what I did wrong. He said Coke. I hit Coke. And I didn't know what happened. And today I can look, you know, today I understand, you know, in 1987 there was Coke and New Coke. And I was 3. And I didn't know that, you know. But I learned fear. I learned to be afraid. I learned that, you know, things could go bad, and yeah, I could do things wrong, and I could disappoint people. You know, and I learned to be ashamed. You know that, you know, my actions. You know, I should be sorry for what I did. You know, if people, you know, if I affected other people, and you know. I don't have any memories before that, even though stuff happened. But the first thing, the thing that's strongest with me, is learning fear and shame. You know, which are the two things that, you know, as you work the program in the Big Book, it brings up over and over again. And, so, you know, when I look at recovery, you know, my sponsor and I, you know, came to the agreement that what I'm trying to recover is what happened before that. You know, he told me in the Bible, it says that, you know, we're all made in God's image. You know, and if I believe that God is a being of pure love, then that means that I was born knowing nothing but love. And at some point, I learned fear, and I learned shame, and I learned selfishness, and I learned all these things that have done so much harm to me over the years. And my goal in recovery is to try to get back to that place where it's nothing but love. And, you know, that took a little convincing, too, because I heard a lot of people tell me that, you know, that they're imperfect people, and, you know, and that, you know, we get back to, you know, I mean, just, I've heard a lot of people tell me otherwise, you know, tell me that they were born sick, and they're, you know, that this is something that, you know, they can only stop drinking or get better, and, you know, with 6 months, a year, or whatever, I mean, kind of listen to everyone and what they say, and, you know, it took a lot of repetition, took a lot of experience over and over again of going back to God, not going to other people, but going to God, doing my 10th and 11th step, you know, till I developed the faith and the confidence that this is how he wants it to be. And once I did that, I actually found a part in the book where, which I now consider my favorite promise, where it says, "We are sure God wants us to be happy, joyous, and free." It's in the back, it's in the family afterwards, after we've done all the steps, you know, the living sober part. And we are sure God wants us to be happy, joyous, and free. And I don't know how many times I read that before then. And I, you know, I think the first time I thought it was like, you know, God wants, yeah, okay, God wants us to be happy, joyous, and free. And then I think after a while I started thinking like, you know, we think we can be happy, joyous, and free. And then, you know, and it took a while before I believed it. And I, you know, I could say that I was sure that that's what He wanted. You know, that He wanted me to be happy, joyous, and free. You know, which means that any time I'm not, you know, that's the self. That's, you know, that's away from recovery. And it's possible. It means it's possible to be at peace, you know, that to have that. And, you know, once I believed, you know, once I knew it was possible, I could do a lot of great things. Said, you know, I had my first drink when I was 13, and you know, to me, everything that happened from that first memory till the day I got sober is me getting further and further away from God. They're all the things that I learned that took me away. You know, all the things that I had to undo to recover. And, you know, my parents got divorced when I was 4, and my mother married a drug addict. She got together with a guy who was very abusive verbally. You know, I used to come home when I was 7, 8 years old, and I'd walk in the door, and he'd say, "Hey, faggot, how's it going?" And, you know, it really affected me. It affected me in ways, you know, I knew it made me angry. You know, I knew I hated him. You know, and even for a while, I knew I wanted, you know, when I was a teenager, when I was first an adult, I knew I wanted to kill him. But I didn't realize until I started doing my inventory how much, like, how deeply it had affected me. Now, I remember being in college one time, and I'd hooked up with a girl I hadn't met before, just some strange girl at a party, one of those college things. And and afterwards, as I like left the party house and I was walking out to my car, I vividly remember walking out the door and thinking, that'll show him. And that's kind of sick. You know, and that's the person that I became as I got away, as I got away from God, further and further away. And, you know, growing up with him, it was only a matter of time before, you know, my mother started drinking. And once she started drinking, it was okay for me to start drinking. We drank together. Later on, you know, once I turned 20 and it was okay, I was old enough, we started doing cocaine together. I don't know how she came up with that age limit, but, needless to say, we had a very sick relationship. You know, and I grew up with her. You know, I grew up around a family that drank and used drugs. You know, and from as soon as I was willing to start doing it, I became part of that circle, part of that family, and it was encouraged. Drug use and drinking were encouraged. And, you know, today I know that, you know, these are people who had no coping mechanisms. You know, my mother never learned how to deal with problems. The person who doesn't know how to live life on life's terms. I can say the same thing about my father. They both had very damaged, sick childhoods. You know, I would never compete with my father. I'd never play that game with him of who had the worst childhood. You know, I lose every time. You know, and my childhood did this to me. You know, it's sick of me to look at them and expect them to have given me something different. You know, to think that these two people could have gotten together and taught a child about love and selflessness and being a good human being and, you know, understanding God and, you know, not carrying around shame and fear and guilt is, would be pretty insane. You know, and, when I understood that, it took away a lot of the resentment. I was able to get rid of a lot of the anger. You know, there's sick people just like me. You know, and I got what they had. They gave me what they had. And, you know, I went off to college. I drank a lot. I got a good job, but I drank a lot. I got a house. I drank a lot. I was actually able, I got a great job when I was 19. I got a job working in radio. And, I was able to put on a suit and tie every day. Worked in radio sales, and most of the guys I worked with were in their 30s or 40s. So every day after work, I went straight out to the bar with them. 5 o'clock, we were in a bar somewhere. And at 19, you know, walk into a bar in between 4 to 5 other grown men. You're all wearing suits and ties, and no one IDs you. So I was able to drink at bars every day. And, but it was horrible. Like, I really enjoyed it. Like, I looked forward to it every day. Like, I never wanted to miss it. But it was so tough because, like, if I drank too much or got out of line, I'd get thrown out of a bar. And I couldn't get thrown out because then they'd find out I was 19 and I couldn't go back. And I had to be so careful. Like, if I got thrown out and they didn't want to leave, I couldn't go into other bars or I couldn't get anything else to drink. Like, I was just done. And I remember, like, just waiting. I couldn't wait till I turned 21. Because when I turned 21, I was finally going to be able to drink the way I wanted to. And, you know, at some point, I lost that job. I didn't lose that job. I lost the house I was living in and created a absolute disaster in every aspect of my life up there. And had to flee back to Florida, leaving a couple warrants. Things were good. Leaving a couple warrants to come home and live with Mom, who was the only person who really didn't care. And, you know, by the time I turned 21, I was back here in Florida, and it was liberating. I could drink the way I wanted to drink. And I had I had what today I call a home bar, which was the bar I went to every day. Like, it was like my home group, but it was a home bar. You know, and I could go to other bars, and I would drink at other bars, and I would see other people, but I always had to go to my home bar every day. And they would throw me out on a regular basis, and it was cool. Because they let me back the next day, so I didn't care. And it wasn't like when I got thrown out of bars in Michigan, you know, when I was younger, because they'd throw me out and I'd walk next door and go into the bar next door and I'd just start drinking there. And, you know, and if I got in too much trouble in that area, I'd drive to another area, drive to International Drive, or I'd drive to downtown, or I'd drive to Metro West, or I'd, you know. There were enough bars in Orlando that I could get thrown out of a lot and still have places to drink until 2 a.m. And, I got everything I wanted. I was able to drink the way I wanted to. And it took 10 months before I was in AA. 2 months before my 22nd birthday, I wound up in Alcoholics Anonymous. Took 10 months of getting exactly what I wanted before I made it here. Which, is really just kind of, you know, that says it all. You know, I remember the last month I was bartending, so it was the only job I could get. And I got my first bartending job. The manager interviewed me. They asked if I had any professional experience. And I said no, but I'm what you would call a top-ranked amateur. And they hired me on the spot. And I actually knew how to make more drinks than most of the other bartenders because I had drank them all. So that came in handy. And bartending was the only job I could get. And I was tending bar when I came in. But it had been a solid 2 weeks before my last night of drinking, where each morning I woke up and tried not to drink. I'd known that I had drank every day from anywhere starting at 10 a.m. to 1 in the afternoon, depending on what time I woke up, till 2, 4, 6 in the morning, depending on what time I passed out. And that had been going on for a couple months. And I had tried to stop drinking for 2 straight weeks. Every day I woke up and I said I wasn't going to drink today. And every night I would either be laying in my bed trying to figure out how it happened, or the next morning I would wake up trying to figure out how it happened. Not everything else that happened during the night, because I was kind of like, you know how that happened. But how the first one, like, I couldn't figure out how it started. And 2 straight weeks, every day I did this. And on the last day of my drinking, one of the last things I did was, it turned out to be our poker night, and I was playing poker with a group of guys, and I won like 2 or 3 straight games in a row. And I'd been drinking, for about 13 hours, and I was sitting there, and the booze had stopped working. I was still drinking, but it felt like I was getting more and more sober. And so eventually I stopped. I had like a half-empty beer in front of me, and I didn't even want it because I had no faith that it would work. And I was sitting there in front of a pile of money, because we just cashed out, and I won like 3 games, and I had a big pile, a couple $100 cash in front of me, and I was absolutely miserable, and I remember thinking to myself, like, if this doesn't do, how could it get better? Like, what could I do better tomorrow that won't make me miserable? And the thought came that, you know, I could not drink. And then I got really, really scared. I got really scared because for the first time, I thought about it and I thought, I might not be able to do that. And then the more I thought about it, what the last 2 weeks had been like, I realized there's no way I can do that. No matter how much I want to not drink tomorrow, I don't think I can not. And it was one of the scariest things that had ever happened to me. I felt so weak and powerless and doomed. I felt doomed, like this was it. I was going to have to be this miserable for the rest of my life, and there was nothing I could do about it. And I actually got up, and the only time I can ever remember doing this, I poured out the other half of my beer, and I actually walked home from the house I was in. I don't think I had my car. I banged up my car that day. I didn't even have my car. I walked home from where I was, and I was lying in bed restless, and after about an hour or so, the thought occurred to me, tomorrow you have to find an AA meeting. And I knew nothing about AA. I had never been to an AA meeting. I'm the first person in my group of degenerates to have found Alcoholics Anonymous. So there were no like people that vanished and I was told they went to AA and I didn't know what it means. I was the first one to vanish. And I had no idea what AA was. Eventually I would look at that, and that was the first time I can remember listening to God. That was the first time I remember hearing God. You know, and today I recognize that voice. Today, you know, I recognize that very soft, calm, peaceful strength when I hear it. My voice in my head doesn't sound like that. One of the clearest incidents that I remember, the most distinct ones, was when I quit smoking. I had about 3 years in sobriety, and my sponsor was in the hospital, very sick, and he was having heart troubles, and they weren't sure at the time, like, if he was going to make it, and they told him he had to quit smoking, and I went home from the hospital, and I sat there, and I had a cigarette, and I was meditating, and I remember the thought just came in, and that same voice, and it said, you know, you should do this, you know, to help him, because you love him. And then the very next thought that came into my head was, son of a bitch. And the way the two sounded was so completely different that I knew one of them was me and one of them was him. And it didn't take long to figure out which one. So, you know, I can recognize that voice today, which is amazing. And now that's what I heard that night. And I knew nothing about it, but the next day I found an AA meeting. And somehow I made it through the day. I was waiting for it. I had to walk to work because I had no car again. It wasn't the first time I had to walk to work because I had no car, but I did that day. I made it through work. I found a meeting that night. I walked into an 8 o'clock men's meeting that Wednesday night, June 21st, 2006. And I got a white chip. I told them why I was there. And guys came up to me afterwards, and they said, do you think you can stay sober tonight? And it was like 9 o'clock. And I thought, you know what, I can go straight home. I can lock myself in my bedroom, and I can just stay in bed until I fall asleep, however long it takes. I'm like, that's a plan. So I said, yes, I can. They said, do you think you can stay sober tomorrow? I said, I have no idea. And they pulled out a meeting guide, and they circled another meeting. And they said, if you want to stay sober tomorrow, you'll be here. And they did that to me for about the first week. You know, the same few guys, they would ask me, do you want to stay sober tomorrow? Then you'll be here. And that's what I did. I went every day for that first week. I kept going, and I kept not drinking. And got a sponsor, I started working through the steps. I came in an atheist. I had no idea of God. I thought that I was personally qualified to prove to you that he didn't exist before I came in. They helped me learn otherwise. We found God together. I remember my sponsor told me, had a couple weeks, and he told me to go home, and he said maybe a week or two. He said, go home and read chapters 1, 2, and 3 of the big book. But whatever you do, do not read chapter 4. He said, you are not ready to read chapter 4. You can't handle it. Do not read it. Please, whatever you do. So I went home and I read chapters 1, 2, 3, and 4. And I got halfway through We Agnostic. And I was on my knees crying like I don't remember ever having cried before, saying the Lord's Prayer, which was the only prayer I knew, over and over and over again. And we started there. When I got to a place where I stopped feeling bad about it, because I felt bad at first. I felt like every person I'd ever talked to about being an atheist, like I was letting them down if I suddenly believed in God, because I was a very sick person. And I had to get over that. And once I was ready, after a meeting, my sponsor took me back into the room, and we got on our knees, and he read the third step prayer to me out of the big book, and I read it back. And that was it. I was in. There was no turning back after that. I started working on my fourth step afterwards. I made it through my fourth step. I did the fifth step. I remember the day I did my fifth step having to call my sponsor because I felt like it was coming for me. I felt like this was the last chance. Like this was the last day. Like if I was ever going to turn back and drink, it would have to be before I did my fifth step. And he talked me through it, and I went straight from work to... I had a new job, wasn't bartending anymore. That didn't work very long. They actually fired me on my 30th day of sobriety. The only time I remember in sobriety actually really wanting to drink. I was convinced I was going to drink. I needed to drink. I didn't know how to deal with getting fired. But it was like 3 hours until the meeting, and it was going to be like my first real chip that I had earned, because it was my 30th day of sobriety. So I told myself that I can go get the chip, and then I'll go to the bar and drink. And that day, I learned that this too shall pass. Mm-hmm. Never let something pass before. It's funny, those coincidences. You know, if it had happened on any other day, I wouldn't be here. So, I went straight to... I actually didn't do my fifth step with my sponsor. I was embarrassed. I came very close with my sponsor. And I didn't want to tell him. I thought he might think less of me. And he said, fine, don't tell me. Just tell someone. But today, at this point, there's nothing in there he doesn't know. But at the time, it made me nervous. And it was more important that I did it than that I did it with him. So I picked some guy that I barely knew from our home group that I never talked to, and I went over to his apartment, and I told him everything. And he might think less of me today, but... I really don't care. It was good. It was really good. It was exactly the way it was supposed to be. And from there I got going to work. And I went back to my sponsor. I went home. My sponsor gave me instructions. He said, go into the big book. He said, read what happens next. And then he said, go, we'll start in the 12 and 12, read 4 and 5, then read what happens next in the big book. So you'll review everything you've done. And then read ahead. Take that hour, sit with God, do the reading, understand where you're going from here. And I did. And we talked about 6 and 7, and he asked if I was ready to make amends, and I said yes, and he said, then we're on 8 and 9. And I thought that was pretty quick. And then throughout, for a while, I would hear people say, that 6 and 7 were the steps that took them the longest. That, they had left so much out and they didn't realize it at the time because they seemed so easy. That they spent years working on them now and perfecting them. And so I got all this. I started getting this guilt, later in sobriety, that maybe I left something out in 6 and 7. And I went back to my sponsor, and he's like, "Didn't you think I would have told you?" He's like, "How do you feel?" I'm like, "I feel great." And he's like, "Did you drink?" I'm like, "No, I haven't drank in years." Then what's the, you know, it took me a little while, and you know, eventually I had to go back into the book and do more thinking, and what I found was that I noticed in step six, oops, wrong side. It says, "We're entirely ready to have God remove all these defects of character." It's the only step that doesn't tell me to do anything. I don't have to come to believe anything. I don't have to make a decision. I don't have to admit anything. I don't have to go to anyone. I don't have to write any list. I don't have to even talk to God about it. It just says, "We're at this point in time, right here and now today, you are entirely ready to have God remove all these defects of character." And it comes right after the fifth step. So I thought back on, you know, what he made me do when I finished the fifth step, going home, sitting with God, reading about it, you know, looking at what comes next. And at that moment in time, I mean, I had just spent like 5 hours talking about every horrible thing that had ever happened to me in my life. Like every bad thing I ever felt, everything I ever thought I did, all the shame and the guilt and the fear that had racked up. I spent like 5 hours talking about this. And at the end of each one, we had to go back and find my part. And there were only, like, so many parts. Like, pretty much it was that I was selfish and self-seeking every time. And I found that, you know, motivated by fear and selfishness, I did all of these terrible things. And they hurt all the people around me. And they hurt me like hell. And it caused all the pain I've ever known in my life. I was absolutely ready for him to take all of that away. I didn't want any more of it. I didn't want to hurt anybody else. I didn't want to feel that type of pain anymore. And I was willing to do anything. I was willing to go back to all the people, meet with them, make amends, fix those relationships. I was willing to try to do good every day to make up for that bad. And you know what, in that hour, that's the sixth and seventh step. You know, I felt that way, and then I prayed and asked him for help, and then I moved on and I started on the action. You know, and I love what it says in the big book, you know, in that part. It's really defined my program over the last few years. And it says, it's one of these that I have up. It says, "Our real purpose is to fit ourselves to be of maximum service to God and the people about us." Oh, and that's what I'm willing to do today. You know, when it talks about, you know, and those promises that the feelings of uselessness will disappear, I had a man point out to me that in We Agnostics, there's a whole, I have this one marked too, hold on. In We Agnostics, there's an entire page that we call the anti-promises now. Either the anti-promises or the definition of the alcoholic, either one. And it says, we had to ask ourselves why we shouldn't apply to our human problems the same readiness to change. And here's the good stuff. We were having trouble with personal relationships. We couldn't control our emotional natures. We were prey to misery and depression. We couldn't make a living. We had feelings of uselessness. We were full of fear. We were unhappy. We couldn't seem to be of real help to other people. Like, the total anti-promises. And I was told early on that, you know, as they edited this, like, anytime they said "we," that was the common consensus of the first 100 men and women. That was their common problem. And I always imagine now that, like, I see them in a room like this, and they're going off, you know, as they're editing it, like, "All right, trouble with personal relationships, show of hands." Put it in the book. Okay. And, you know, that's the problem that apparently every alcoholic has. And, you know, feelings of uselessness are a big one. You know, they're one of the ones that creep up more today than they did before. And what I found is that, you know, I can't be of service to people at all times. You know, I don't get to do this every day. You know, I go to meetings every day. I work with other people. I carry the message. But I can't actually be of physical service to another human being all day long. But that's not what it says. It says, you know, to fit myself what I found is that as long as I'm working on me, I don't have those feelings. And anytime I'm not actually with someone, anytime I'm not being of service, and when I go to work, I'm being of service. When I go to work, I'm helping other people. They wouldn't be paying me if they didn't need me. You know, and if I'm not helping other people, I'm working on me. I'm in the book. I'm in the rooms. I'm talking to people. I'm me and God. You know, and it makes me more fit to help. Gives me more peace that I can share with other people. And I can do that each day today. Now, real quick, you know, close wrap up, and I wanted, you know, I started off saying, you know, it's really important about finding God, and to me, as I look at my sobriety has been marked by, I mark it by my major meditations. Now, when I work my 11th step, very similar to the way it says to work the 10th step in the 12 and 12. You know, and it talks about having these three cycles. You know, the one like into action in the book, where we start every morning with a meditation and we end every day with an inventory. You know, and then it says that we should have this daily inventory constantly through us, checking to see if we're carrying anything other than love. You know, if there's anything else we need to get rid of lest it hurt someone else or ourselves. And then it says that we have to have this semi-annual, this major house cleaning for anything we might have missed along the way, every 6 to 12 months. And I do that with my meditation as well today. And every 6 to 12 months, I try to have a major meditation. You know, I'm constantly in contact with my higher power throughout the day. At any time, I can reach out. I can slow it down and stop it. Get close. Clear it out. Get me out. You know, but a real major one where I take 45 minutes, an hour, and it's me and God. And to me, my sobriety is marked by those. You know, the first one I did had about 9 months, and that was the one I kind of mentioned earlier, how wounded I was. You know, and that was when I first really kind of understood that I knew nothing about love. You know, that this was about love, and that my whole life before coming here was nothing like this, which means my whole life was nothing like love. The things I thought were love, the things I thought I knew, were not. They were wrong. And I learned that peace I was feeling there that day, that's love. And that's what I need to find. And it was actually that moment, you know, the only amends I hadn't been able to make was the one with my mother. I hadn't been able to go back and talk to her. And after I got off my knees that day, I went straight to her, and we were able to start, you know, fixing that. I was able to start talking to her. And throughout my sobriety, I've had more of those. I remember I had one a couple months later where, you know, I had a bunch of stuff I didn't know how to sort out, and I had just gotten a year, and I was supposed to live, you know, now I figure, like, I'm supposed to build this life. There's none of those, don't do this, wait a year, no major decision. Now I'm supposed to make decisions. Like, I got to make good ones. And, you know, and the next one, you know, it brought me peace and closure with some other relationships. You know, and it taught me how to really love, you know, that how to really love people. You know, how to be a friend and have people in my life. And you know, as I go through each successive one, you know, they detail, you know, after that second one, about 6 months later, I met the woman who would be my wife. And, you know, I had moved to New York, and I had taken myself away from all the people who were using. And at first, I thought that I was surrounding myself by good people because they didn't drink and do drugs. And what I found out was that you don't have to drink and do drugs to be selfish, hateful people. And the woman I met showed me that, you know, how to live, how to love people, even if you don't like them. You know, she helped me be a better person. And you know, and the next time I had a big major meditation, you know, it was really about, you know, this could be love. This is love. This is what he's felt for me all along. This is what he's always wanted me to feel every moment of every day. And I was never able to find it before. You know, now that I've found him, I know just a little bit. I can do it. I know what it looks like. I know what it feels like. I know how to get closer to it. And I've been able to work since then on, you know, that helped me do my 10th step. I was having a lot of trouble with my 10th step. I wanted to get a tattoo that said 10 and 11 to remind me to do my 10th and 11th step. And with this meditation, I learned, you know, it helped me do that inventory of what am I feeling? Is it love? And, now, I know I'm out. I've been blessed, you know, to have relationships with people in these rooms, friends like Marissa, who I met on a, who I reacquainted with on a 9-step call. I had to make an amends. And, you know, I'll end with this. I met Marissa at a bar for a 9-step call. Her choice, not mine. And I only had about 5 months sober. And we sat in like the dining area, which she thought was really weird. And I talked to her, and I was open and honest, and I showed her my list. And she was actually first on the list, because I'd been very haunted by the way I acted, very ashamed of the way I acted the last time I'd seen her. And she told me that it was okay. She's like, we were both a mess. Don't worry about it. And I didn't feel like I could cross her name off the list. It wasn't my first demand. I'd crossed a couple others off. I didn't feel like I could cross her off. And so stayed in contact with her. We started becoming friends again. And she would, like, behave a little when I was around. And then I would see her the next morning and realize, like, nothing we did could make you look like this. And this went on for a couple months. And then one day she called me and she asked me for help. And I was able to pick her up and take her to a meeting. And I knew enough by then that you pick him up, you don't let him meet you. Pick her up and took her to a meeting, and I heard her, you know, heard her say, my name's Marissa, I'm an alcoholic. And it hit me so hard. And we spent the whole day together, and, you know, I introduced her to, like, every woman I knew in the program. And at the end of the day, I brought her home, and we got rid of everything in her house, and, you know, and they had given her meetings and, you know, asked her if she could stay sober tomorrow. I told her, you know, go here if you want to stay sober tomorrow. And when I left, I pulled out, I was keeping it like in my wallet. I pulled the list out of my wallet and I felt like it's time. I was able to cross her off that list. And, you know, that's how God works in my life today, because today I have this. And, I'd just like to say thank you all for letting me speak tonight.